Thank you very much.
I mean, by the way, oh, is it recording started? Yeah.
Yes, recording has started. So Stephen, thank you for being with us today. Before we begin, can I have your permission to record this interview?
Yes, by all means.
Thank you, Stephen. So today's interview will center about your thoughts and reflections about critical thinking in adult learning. So maybe for a start, can you tell us about yourself and your background?
Okay, well, I was born and grew up in Northern England. I didn't do very well at school at all, didn't like school. And I left school and went to a college in Manchester to learn about tailored garment manufacturing, so garment manufacturing. And I studied that for 2 years in Manchester in a course wholly based within the college, Hollins College it was called. And then after that, I left and found employment in the clothing manufacturing sector. And this was the right at the end of the 1960s, beginning of the 70s, and it was very high employment. It wasn't problems finding a job. And I worked in the garment manufacturing in a number of companies in Britain before traveling to Australia, and then worked in garment manufacturing in Australia. Throughout my career in garment manufacturing, though, there was always a concern about manufacturing going to countries which had low labor costs because manufacturing of clothes is very labor intensive. So there's a constant battle to compete against garments which could be made in other countries far more cheaply and imported. So a lot of my work in the clothing industry was actually, because I was a designer, I designed the products and organized the manufacture. Was trying to find ways in which we could, problem solve. You could make garments more cheaply, and so I was constantly involved in thinking critically about the production of garments and how these could be made well, but also as cost effectively as possible. Then at some point, I could see the writing on the wall, so to speak. And decided then to transfer across to education. I became a teacher of clothing in the technical and further education system in Queensland in Australia. And I guess the equivalent would be in Singapore, either the Polytechs or ITE. And so I was a teacher in that, and I did my diploma of teaching while I was teaching. And then I became a head of a department, and then shifted from that into an area that was about professional development of teachers, developing teacher skills, and then going on to professional development of people working in the vocational education sector. From there, I then went and had a policy position, which was about the reforming and restructuring the Australian economy, supported by the development of skills. And this was in the 1980s. And my job was to work with the unions and the employers to bring about changes so that skills would be a central part of how conditions and salaries, etc., were negotiated. Now, this work was really interesting because it took me to a whole range of workplaces across Queensland of all kinds, different kinds of workplaces. And it was in one of these workplaces where I had this epiphany, this moment. And that was, I was in a town which it was south of Cairns, which had a huge sugar mill that is taking sugar cane and making sugar and molasses from the sugar cane. And what I was aware of, this town was built around the mill. And if you've ever seen a mill in operation, it's a fairly impressive sight. And what I learned was that all of the knowledge associated with the mill came from within that community. And very, very few of the workers had actually undertaken, educational provisions to develop those skills. So the skills had to be developed through the work. And this coincided with a lot of my personal experience, but other experiences of coming across workers who were doing highly demanding work, but didn't have a formal initial preparation for it. One of the other things was that my own experience when I completed my course of clothing manufacturing way back in 1971, I think it was, I had a very difficult transition into work because what I'd learnt in the college, in the classrooms in the college, didn't seem to apply in the workplace. And I, although I did very well and got very high grades, and I was seen to be as an excellent student in a college situation, what I found was that when I tried to transfer that into the workplace, I couldn't make sense that it was so different. And that a lot of my learning across working life in my career in clothing manufacturing came from my work-based experiences. So this moment then came together for me in thinking that I needed to understand more about how people learn their skills. And the evidence was that lots of people were learning highly demanding skills in the absence of educational programs. Now, I'm not saying that's a good thing. What I'm simply saying is that people have learned through practice, and this was important. So I then took an opportunity to undertake a secondment to the university to do a PhD based upon how people learn through work. And the field that I looked at was actually hairdressing, because I wanted to find an occupation which was practiced across different work settings and had different goals and requirements. And so it was that study really, my PhD study, the doctoral study, which provide the foundations for much of the work I've continued with and work in today. So I guess the important point there is that that critical thinking became an essential part of my work in the clothing sector. And then as an educator, because what I was working with was students who were highly motivated, highly keen, and they were making their garments, and I had to help them solve problems. And then working, within the policy context of trying to respond to big policy challenges, it was important to think critically. So that's a bit of the background. That's a bit of the background, if that's helpful.
Thanks, Stephen, for sharing with us your life story. So I see how you went from being a student, immersing yourself in the culture, the workplace, learning through workplace. Then after that, you went on to policy side, and now you are a professor in adult and vocational education in Griffith University. So I think you have, from your history, you've been with Griffith for close to 30 years or more than that. Yes.
Getting close.
So can you tell us about the work that you are currently doing at Griffith University, and what are some of the projects you have in the area of adult learning?
Okay. Well, the central focus of my work is really to understand the relationship between work and learning. And that is the ways in which learning and work coexist, and how learning for work occurs, and how learning through work occurs. Mm-hmm. And so that's a central focus for my work. And currently I have a lot of projects, perhaps too many, but one of them is exploring the learning across adults' working lives. And this is a large project, and it focused in the first phase on about 30 mature age Australians and mapped their learning experiences across their working lives to do a retrospective account of the challenges that they'd faced and how they'd overcome those challenges, the transitions that they had undertaken, and the learning that allowed them to negotiate those transitions, to take new jobs, to come to Australia, to develop further their skills. Now, in the second phase of this study, we've changed it to respond to the challenges of COVID, because obviously we didn't know COVID was coming along just like everybody else. But what we're doing in the second phase is mapping the learning of people who've been affected by COVID, workers. And that is, for instance, workers whose work has just disappeared, airline pilots, for instance, and also workers whose work has expanded because of the impact of COVID. So that's really a very detailed study, again, in the second phase of about 30 people, exploring in great detail the kind of learning they've had across working life. In other projects in Australia, there is one which is looking at the impact of rural general medical practice brought about by COVID, and the way that that practice has had to change to respond to telehealth, to, you know, dealing with patients online and social distancing, but also the changes within those practices, the new roles that receptionists and practice managers have to play, given the circumstance. Then there's other projects in the healthcare where we're focusing on what constitutes what's called clinical teaching, how senior clinicians teach, inverted commas, registrars or medical students in hospital settings. And in that project, we're taking videos, we're doing interviews, but also taking videos of teaching moments within hospitals, and then getting the participants to consider and evaluate those experiences. Then I have a project in Norway, which is very difficult to engage with at the moment for obvious reasons. And that's looking at resilience in healthcare workers and how healthcare workers manage the changes that have been brought about, and how, and the particular focus I've got on is how collaborative learning can support that. And then in Singapore, currently I have three projects. One on how continuing education and training provisions might best be organised and enacted to meet the needs of working age Singaporeans. One on the on how employee-driven innovations can be encouraged and enacted in small to medium-sized enterprises. And then a project looking at how we can develop adaptive capacities within the PSEIs, the post-secondary education institutions in Singapore. And that's a new project, and you know, it's very, very consistent with this concern on critical thinking. Yeah, so that's the current scope of the work that I'm doing, and all of them in different ways emphasize criticality in thinking and acting, albeit in different ways.
Thanks, Stephen. So it seems that you are contributing significantly to the academia across the globe, both in Europe, in Australia, and in Singapore.
Well, it'd be nice to think that. It's all being done via Zoom and Teams at the moment, but there's not much direct interaction, but it's, yes, yeah, certainly engaging with colleagues globally.
Yes. So we mentioned the last part you mentioned about critical thinking. I'm interested to find out how you would define critical thinking.
Okay, yeah, that's a good question. I mean, there's lots of views on, you know, critical thinking. Some people suggest it's socially critical thinking, so you actually look for contradictions in what goes on. Other people view it in being critical about things, but I view it in terms of just thinking critically, that when you're confronted with a problem or an issue, you need to engage with it and try and get down to the essence of the problem, the task, the perturbation, and respond to it. So, I mean, it's like, to use an expression, it's like pulling off the glossy cover and trying to get to the actual essence of what the issue is, and then thinking quite openly about the kind of responses that might be required for it. So let me give you an example. A few years ago, I was talking to a senior pediatrician, and he was concerned that young training specialists in pediatrics were having difficulty because they couldn't get access to children. And that is because when children come to hospitals, they're often accompanied by their parents. And the interaction between the pediatricians and the children is often quite restricted. And many of these medical students being trained to be pediatricians didn't actually have younger siblings, and so didn't have experience of how to engage with children. And because of the lack of experience, he was concerned about the ability of pediatricians to interact with children. So I then thought about the problem and then made a suggestion, which I guess would be described as being left of field. And that was that for the registrars to go and spend time in a kindergarten, because if the concern was how that these medical specialists can come to learn, to engage with children without parents intervening all of the time, that there needed to be an environment where they could develop those skills. And so I was suggesting that they should be romping around in the sandpit at the local kindergartens, because that's an opportunity to develop those skills in a benign environment. Now, whether you know, trainee pediatricians would see that as being an appropriate learning experience is quite another thing. But it was taking what is the problem, how can we address that, and one way of addressing it in that instance would be to provide an appropriate experience to develop those skills. Another example, I think, is when recognition of prior learning first came out. I had a role in Australia about how it should be enacted. And one of the problems that came up very quickly is that the way the model had been set up wasn't really adequate for the task that it was set to undertake. So, for instance, it was suggested that this could be very helpful for women who'd been looking after children for long periods of time, and that they could get the skills they developed in managing households, etc., recognized. However, the reality was that RPL is normally based upon outcomes of courses, syllabus documents, and modules, etc. And unless the modules directly were aligned with the kinds of things that women had been doing in their homes, it was unlikely that they would be able to get credit for it. So you looked at the task and you realized that the RPL process was really about getting credit in existing courses. And if a course didn't exist, so there wasn't a basis for you to be for your learning to be recognized. And that played out in a very particular way in the state in which I live, Queensland, where there was an RPL process put forward for workers in the railway system. However, there was no benchmarks, there was no standards for their learning to be assessed against, because there'd been no courses in how you are a fettler, how you build bridges, how you maintain tracks, how you organize signals and station management. So those workers were unable to have their skills recognized because of a lack of absence of benchmarks. So that led me to conclude that without having adequate benchmarks, the RPL process would fall over. So yeah, so it's trying to get down to saying what is the issue here, and tearing away the gloss, tearing away the rhetoric, and saying if this is about providing recognition of prior learning, there has to be a mechanism and for actually that learning to be recognized.
Okay. Thanks, Stephen. So just then you mentioned about you do quite a lot of work with adult learners, and you mentioned about having the benchmarks. So from your opinion, are there any components of critical thinking? If so, what are they?
Well, I mean, there's lots of elements of critical thinking. Are you referring to in work or in education or how?
Okay, so we are interested in the area of adult learning and adult teaching. Sure. So when we talk about adult learners, it seems that there's a generalization that you can't teach old dogs new tricks. And because these adult learners, they come to the educators with a lot of different levels of experience. So sometimes they may be close to what you want to tell them or what you want to teach them. So how do you think this critical thinking component is applicable to the teaching of adult learners in today's world?
Yes, I think it's probably very central to it. In lots of ways, both in terms of what is required for the workplace and also what is required for educational provisions. I mean, educationally, if we set it aside, again, if we go back and tear off the gloss, critical thinking is a process. It's not an outcome. It's a process. It's a process that leads to outcomes. So the focus, the educational focus, needs to be on a process of learning. So rather than continually focusing on the outcomes, you would perhaps focus the assessment, the curriculum focus, is on the actual process that people are engaged in to come with the outcome. Not so much the outcome, but the actual process that they focus on. Now, unfortunately, there's been a very strong emphasis on learning outcomes that are measurable being accepted within certainly vocational education globally through competency-based training, but also in other measures that are associated with performativity. Now, this actually, I think, works against the development of capacities like critical thinking. And I should add here straight away that what we're talking about in terms of critical thinking is that which experts possess. And what we know that experts have is profound knowledge in their domain and the ability to utilize that knowledge effectively, manipulate it and use it effectively. So it's quite often domain specific. So in terms of the very specific focus on adult learners is that everything I know about teaching adults over the last 30 years or 40 years is that the experiences need to be relevant and interesting and engaging. And when people, and to actually engage in effortful processes such as, you know, what is referred to as critical thinking, there has to be interest there has to be intentionality there, and there also has to be a base of knowledge there. So I think a focus that's more on promoting learning rather than teaching is presumably the way to go. I think that's my quick response to that question.
Yeah, thanks, Stephen. So you were talking about peeling off the gloss cover and getting down to the core of what critical thinking is about for each individual. Am I right to say that?
Yes, so it's taking the issue up and understanding what is the problem and then trying to think broadly and critically about it, not just constrained within the within the orthodox response.
Yeah, I understand. So thanks, Stephen. So when you are, I want to know and find out from you, is there any set of standards you use when you are trying to evaluate somebody's thinking?
Well, yes. I mean, it's an element of what we do in higher education assessment, that we're looking for the process has the argument made, is the argument justified, on what basis is it justified, is the reasoning that sits behind it effective. Now, I think what we need to do is, in terms of assessment, if that's the question, we need to apply that not just to written assignments, but to assessing student knowledge more broadly. So, for instance, in many countries, in some occupations, oral assessments are used to see whether, when presented with a problem, the person can respond, and respond thinking, in their thinking then is demonstrated through their oral presentations. Sometimes these can be directly related to the kind of occupational tasks that people engage in. So healthcare is a good example, because when you're caring for patients, what you normally need to be able to do is to take the history of the patient and then do an examination. And then through a process of elimination, of try and work out what the problem is, and then provide remedies for that, and then monitor the remedies to see if they're being effective. So it's the process, the lead process is referred to as differential diagnosis, of counting things in and out, etc. Now, one very good way of developing those skills is that in clinical settings, when you have, in hospital settings, beg your pardon, when you've got the ward rounds, you know, the lead clinician will examine the patient and then make judgments, and they'll speak aloud, or they can speak aloud about what they're doing. And that can be a very good model for less experienced clinicians to understand what's being stated. However, having said that, the process needs to be underpinned by the person having a body of knowledge to make sense of what the clinician is providing. Then, for instance, there's the ways of engaging, because engagement is very important in this. It's the learner needs to be doing this. It's not a process of teaching. So in some clinical settings, what I've seen happen is before the ward round starts, the senior clinician will say to each of the medical students or the junior doctors, you'll be doing this, you'll be asking these questions, you'll be making the diagnosis of patients as they go around, so that they're actually actively engaged in those activities, which requires them to engage in those processes, and that's how they develop their capacities. It's no good them completing their medical education or their registrar becoming specialists if they haven't actually, develop those kinds of capacities, because they'll require them on that Monday morning they commence their new job. So what I'm suggesting there is that these are capacities which need to be developed, and they're also capacities that is very much premised upon the learner developing them, not being taught them. However, having models can be very, very helpful for the learner to follow through, to imitate. And that's not a bad word, imitation, by the way, because it's a structure, it's a way of engagement that can be highly pedagogic.
Thanks, Stephen. So far, we have spoke about the importance of critical thinking within the adult learning classroom. So if we make the, a central tenet of continuous education and training is to be able to apply the knowledge and skills gained from the classroom back to the workplace. So in your opinion, how important is this element of critical thinking in today's workplaces?
Well, yes, and it's obviously because the nature of work is constantly changing, and occupational practice is constantly changing, and certainly the last 18 months has shown us all the way that work has to change, and sometimes has to change very, very quickly in response to things like the pandemic. So this requires new ways of thinking, and so that's where I think this thinking critically comes in. In terms of how this all plays out for workplaces, I view this as having three kinds of changes occur. Firstly, there's the strategic kind of change. That is when a company decides to go in a particular direction, do something different, or have a particular focus, or change something significant about its practice. The second one is changes in the procedures of how the work is undertaken, and this is often impacted by technology, the use of digitalized work, transformation in the way that work was undertaken. And then the third one is the kind of procedural developments that work processes become refined, improved, and honed. Now, whenever you have these changes occur, and particularly when they come from outside the workplace, it inevitably requires that these changes to technology or work requirements need to be tailored and fitted to the particular requirements of the workplace. Now, one of the things I think that goes on is there's a co-occurrence between learning and innovation, because to innovate, you have to come up with something new. So critical thinking then leads to learning and higher order learning, which is a very important part of it. And secondly, that to implement an innovation, you've also reliant upon people's learning. So innovation and learning, I think, co-occur. That is that when you do something new, when you generate a new idea, when you implement a new process, learning arises, and that innovations themselves are reliant upon workers learning and thinking critically and being able to bring about change. So any opportunity for workers to engage in innovations, being encouraged to come up with innovations, developing responses, monitoring them, it seems to be particularly important. And the reason I'm saying about initiation, enacting and monitoring is that this is what we know is very important for developing expertise in a particular field, and of which critical thinking is a key part of it. Because it's not just about coming up with an idea, it's about then implementing that idea, and then, or process or procedure or whatever it is, and then monitoring it to see in what ways it's effective, and then making it more and more effective. So just seeing recently, for instance, one of these, Elon Musk, for instance, trying to take his rocket off and land it in the same spot. And I think the first four attempts were absolute failures. The fourth one was pretty close to it. And then now they've finally got it right to make it happen. So they've been honing and revising, you know, the systems to bring the rocket back safely to ground. And you know, it's that process of monitoring what you're doing, revising it, refining it to achieve the goals. And so it's a very active process, and it requires critical thinking all the way through. So, I mean, that was always part of my work in manufacturing, because you're always dealing with these kind of problems that occur, and you need to be able to respond to them, often in very real time.
So, Stephen, given the changing nature of the workplace, how do you think we can nurture critical thinking in the workforce of today?
Yes, well, as I said, I think it's necessary to give workers discretion. The PIAAC data for Singapore and other countries indicates that workers of all kinds and classifications are engaging in routine problem solving quite frequently, but also non-routine problem solving. And then when you engage in routine problem solving, you're refining and honing what you know. But when you engage in non-routine problem solving, you're actually developing not only your own knowledge, but you're also talking about workplace innovations. So the PIAAC data says very, very clearly, 35 countries, of which Singapore is one, that workers are, of all kinds and classifications, are engaged in non-routine problem solving of the kind which requires critical thinking, but also through that critical thinking develops further their learning, but also are innovations in the workplace. Now, that can only come about when workers, so the workers have the capacity to do that, workers of all levels. And by the way, the category of workers that engage in that type of non-routine problem solving at the highest level is not the professions, it's actually technicians. And that makes sense in some sense. But so it's not just some kind of hierarchy that, you know, people working in food outlets, in food courts can't think critically, whereas doctors can. It's not that at all. All humans have got this capacity. That then suggests then, if all humans have this capacity, that it's the environmental factors which will encourage that, allow that to take place. So this then points to the way that work is organized, and that the discretion afforded to workers to actually be able to, in incremental ways, to make suggestions and bring about change to improve practice. And then I come back, therefore, to these three levels that I referred to, and that is the top level, massive strategic change. And of course, that has to be taken by workers of a particular kind, and they're normally the ones who actually, you know, in the CEOs, the managing directors. And then there's the second level of change, which are these workplace processes. And they're often initiated by people who understand the work processes and how the work processes need to be improved, and bring in things like digital technologies or new equipment or new ways of organizing work. But there's also that key focus on the procedural developments that workers can initiate and bring about themselves, because again, these are the people who are actually doing the tasks. So at every level in that hierarchy, it's the people who are doing the tasks, if they're given the discretion, that would seem to be an important step forward. And what we're aware of is that the Ministry of Manpower and the Ministry of Education, I think it was in 2016, were in responding to the Singapore PIAAC data, pointed out the importance of workers being given discretion in the workplace, being given more opportunities, because what happened was in Singapore is that compared with other countries, Singaporean workers were seen to be good problem solvers, but on the measures of discretion, workplace discretion about the organization of work, the ability to change tasks and to do things differently, that was lower than many other other counterpart countries. And so this led then to that request by MOM and MOE jointly to suggest to Singaporean workplaces that they provide that capacity. And part of that, I think, is changing, to use a colloquial phrase, the mindset. And that is, some Singaporean workers see themselves as just rank and file, that it's not their responsibility and job to bring about innovations, to make improvements, that this is somebody else's responsibility. And that probably is inconsistent with occupational and workplace requirements, which are constantly changing. So critical thinking at all levels, but critical thinking that is encouraged, supported in the workplace. I mean, this is not about people just being allowed to, you know, dream up something and implement it, but it's a managed process, but it engages people and supports them.
Thanks, Stephen. So, you know, with the advent of the Skills Future Initiative, we see many adult workers coming back to PSEIs for their continuous education and training, or what we call CET. How then can we incorporate or teach critical thinking within the CET classroom?
Yes, I think it comes back to processes, the tasks that are set for people and the kind of assessment requirements that are undertaken. And how people are directed to them. It's interesting, if you look across human history, what you'll find is that apprentices in an earlier era, apprenticeship really was a model of learning. It's only in the last 140 years it's become a model of education. And in apprenticeships, the apprentice was the one who had to do the thinking and acting, had to work things out. And it's, in essence, across a range of cultures and countries, the apprentice was, it was their job to find out what to learn, how to learn, and that what constituted effective learning. So that this was their responsibility. Now, if you compare the way that we've gone in modern educational societies, school societies, we tell students, this is the assessment task you need to do. This is what you've got to do to be completing. This is the criteria you need to achieve it. And this is what you need to do. It's obviously the virtual opposite of how occupational skills have been developed across human history, because it takes the onus upon the learning and focus away from the learner and puts it on the educational institution. Now, having said that, I'm just making that point to say that things in some sense are set out very clearly, the path set out very clearly, and doesn't position the learner as a discoverer, but rather as somebody who has to follow a particular pathway. And I use that term advisedly. So I think it's a question of focusing on the kind of activities and the processes that sit behind them. So, for instance, years ago, I used to teach, as I said, in students how to make and design garments in my teaching career. And this was a great area to teach in, because the students would come up with a concept and then seek advice on how to make the patterns and how to construct the garments. And they were wholly engaged in the task. It was a great task for them to be involved in, to be participating. It was a great area to teach in. It was just wonderful. However, good as it may be, it's also important to provide an adequate educational experience. And surprisingly enough, often coming up with a closed problem is better than an open problem. So, for instance, you could say to a student, go off and design a dress. Okay, you could say that, and they can go off and design it. You could say to a student, though, go off and design a dress that has to retail for $18.50. That's a totally different problem. Because designing a dress, you could spend thousands of fabric, you could send it off to somewhere to get beaded or whatever. But the reality in the clothing industry is that you have to have a garment that retails at a certain price. Retailing of that, you mean then you have to work back and find out how much the manufacturing's cost. You then have to balance out whether you spend the money on fabric or on needle time, accessories, etc. So I think it's a question of providing tasks and providing experiences like that, which is great that, that people, learners want to engage in. But within that, there's also how can you construct the task in a way which develops the kind of capacities and understandings which are appropriate for the kind of informed understandings that people will need to practice that. I don't know if that makes sense, but I remember, for instance, one time I was visiting one of the other polytechnics in Singapore, Temasek, I think it was, where the information technology students, they have the role and responsibilities for maintaining the students' laptops and portable tablets and stuff. And so the IT students were actually engaged in that everyday problem solving. Of sorting out the particular problems that students have with their devices. And this engages them not only authentically in those tasks, but there's also clear goals to be achieved, you know, to get the computers working. And, you know, that inevitable field of having different devices of different age, different software, different kinds of incompatibilities really engages those students in authentic, experiences that require critical thinking to achieve those outcomes. So I'm sure similar things occur in other polytechnics, but I'm just taking that as an example of where not only was the task engaging and interesting for IT students fiddling around with computers, but also that there were critical skills required to problem solve and resolve the issues that the other students in the Polytech were facing. So it's important that it can be interesting, engaging, authentic, but the most important thing I think is that it's, you know, a kind of task is provided that engages the students in ways that are realistic, authentic, but also demand critical thinking, but most importantly, it puts the learner in the driver's seat. They're actually having to do the thinking and acting. Then I guess the assessment of that is one of process, where you see the processes that students went through to achieve those outcomes and an assessment of that. I don't know if that's helpful.
Yes, that's very helpful. Thanks, Stephen. So, do you think there will be any challenges and to implementing the critical thinking in the adult classroom? What do you think is the most significant obstacle to inculcating this critical thinking within the CET classroom?
Well, I guess that comes down to the practice and the epistemologies of the people who are teaching. There's a lot of, it's curious because people who are often teaching in courses, preparing people for the workforce or continuing education and training, there's lots of challenges there. And one is about the credibility of being a teacher. And the idea is then that you're supposed to be a, you know, an expert and do that. That can be very difficult, particularly if you've been out of your work for some time. So the, a key task then is to take the focus off yourself as a teacher and think about the facilitation of learning. So it's not just doing what I'm doing now, and that is talking, but actually providing experiences for students to engage, etc., etc. Now, having said that, it's also important that students have a foundation of knowledge to work on, because that, as I've said, most problem solving is within a domain of knowledge, and you need some kind of a foundation. But that foundation can be developed through providing students with experiences and then getting them to critically appraise them. That's been a reasonably effective way, I think, of doing that. So having some base of knowledge, using that knowledge in an incremental way to build that knowledge seems to be important. And all too often there is the statement that time is precious and we need to teach students content. I'm not sure that's terribly true, and I'm certainly not sure that's terribly effective, because you know, how much is learnt or taken or recognized from, you know, a teaching moment is often quite limited. So the idea that if you talk to somebody for 3 hours, they've learned a lot, I think is highly problematic. But rather provide experiences to people so that they can engage and construct the knowledge. Teachers construct their own knowledge, but it's the students need to construct the knowledge. So yes, providing them with readings, pre-readings to do, to understand the field, but then provide activities then which are interesting and engaging. And being realistic about it, that a lot of that comes down to the quality of the activities you provide in the classroom, if classrooms exist, but also the assessment tasks, making the assessment task interesting, but also make it one that in some sense challenges the learner and gets them to justify the outcomes that they generate.
So thanks Stephen for this. You know, with the COVID-19 situation, learning has undergone, or maybe adult learning has, even general education has undergone a paradigm shift, where we used to have face-to-face classes. Now the online class is the preferred or primary mode of learning for both adult and school-aged children. What do you think, or from your observation, what are the mega trends of the workplace and education post-COVID?
Well, let me just go back and then answer the question in two stages. The first thing I think in terms of readiness is, in terms of the first question is one of readiness. And that is, to what degree are the students ready to engage in the sort of online education provisions that have come through COVID? So, and it, you know, this is a particular challenge for people who are not familiar with electronic technology and how to use it effectively for educational purposes. And that's not just the students, that's obviously the educators as well. So I think readiness is a very important concept. And that is, are the students ready to engage, and are the teachers ready to teach through online and provide experiences through online provisions? So I think in both instances, that readiness needs to be addressed. And part of that for the students then is easing them into the process, making the process familiar, and hopefully the platforms easy to understand and engage with. And then for the teachers, actually developing the very specific skills associated with being able to use online education. And one observation that came up recently was that all of us have had lots of experience of somebody standing out in front of us and giving us a talk. Not many of us have had lots of experiences of different people presenting online education. So you know, there's a need for models that's to be made explicit, and there's a need for support, particularly for teachers who are often engaging in fairly unfamiliar terrain. Within all of that, we also need to recognize that not everything can be effectively learned through online education. And so we need to sort of delineate those things which are about content that students can engage with online, but also be aware that there will be certain things which students will need some different kind of experience, face-to-face experience or whatever. Now, having said that, again, there are lots of procedural skills that can be developed online through the videos, etc., which are available to show you how to do things. But there might be the need for somebody to assist and piece all of that together. In terms of readiness to engage, I just want to make a point about what's referred to as advanced organisers. And this goes back to something which Orsabell in the 1960s or 60s came up with. And the point that he made is that if somebody comes into an instructional encounter with some knowledge, they have the structures in place to make sense of what is being presented. But if they don't have that, the information that's given out has no place to be organized and understood. So there needs to be the readiness of the students and the educators, but also the students, I think in particular, need to have some level of advanced organizers so that they know how to structure and engage with the content. So they've got some means, but it's a bit like if I was to go to a country, to China tomorrow, or a country which I know nothing about the language, I simply won't learn by being immersed in that unless I have some understandings of the language structure and the basis for understanding it. So just having the experience alone may not be sufficient. I need some structure to help me understand the language. But moving on to your second part of your question, which is about, oh, this 21st century skills and the kind of capacities and are going to be required in this COVID era. What I propose is three things. Firstly, I don't see moving away from having domain-specific knowledge, that is, profound knowledge of a particular area. Now, in the 1970s, it was suggested by some people that because, you know, knowledge is constantly changing, work requirements are constantly changing, that we shouldn't teach students content, we should just teach problem solving. However, the evidence is that that's simply not successful. You actually need a domain of knowledge to solve problems in. You know, the example I use is that general problem solving strategies have been shown to be useful at a very, very general level, but such a general level are not particularly helpful. You know, think before you act, look before you leap, you know, try before you buy, that sort of thing. But when it comes down to specific occupational areas, you know, the kind of problem solving skills you need for baking a wedding cake are very different than the kind of problem solving skills you need for landing a 737 in a tropical storm. You know, both are found within the domain of knowledge. So, and indeed, it would seem that there's often greater specialization occurring. Anybody that's had any interaction with a medical specialist knows that they have very, very, very specific, deep knowledge of one specific area of human anatomy and health. And they don't know about the other stuff, or they've forgotten about the other stuff. They have profound knowledge of a couple of areas. And that seems to be, that's the first thing. So I think we need to develop domain-specific knowledge and recognize that it's changing. The second point there is adaptability of that knowledge. It will change. I once put to a very senior clinician saying that that the canons of medical knowledge probably hasn't changed much in his career. And he said, no, they've actually changed. He said, only about 5% of what he learned at medical school many years ago is relevant today. He was saying, because it's all changed. So the adaptability there is being open to this body of knowledge changing, but also being applied in different ways in different settings. And the example I use a lot is that in a country like Australia, what a nurse does in a major hospital is very different than what they do in a general practice, but it's very different than what they do in a regional hospital, and it's very different than what they do in a remote hospital or a mining camp or something like that. So the actual need is to adapt your domain-specific knowledge, in that case of nursing, to very, very different circumstances brought about by the practice. And then the third one, so we've had domain-specific knowledge, we've had adaptability of that knowledge, and the third one really is about, I guess, something called connection. And that is that while many of the problems we solve, we base our knowledge on domain-specific knowledge, there's other domain-specific knowledges we need to engage with. And that then suggests we need to step outside of the very specific knowledge that we have and be open to engaging with others. And again, referring to healthcare, what is being suggested is that there's a growing need for interprofessional working and learning, because doctors and nurses and dietitians and physiotherapists all need to come together to assist patient care, inform and assist patient care. So the three things, I think the meta things are still having profound knowledge of a domain, having that critical thinking that allows you to adapt it to new circumstances, but be open to changes to it. And then also the ability then to extend that knowledge when working with people and with other domains of knowledge to engage with them and make sense of it. So that's some of the things I think are important for what's often referred to as 21st century skills and the pandemic era we live in, which is continues to throw challenges at us.
Thanks, Stephen. So, you know, at Republic Polytechnic, we pride ourselves and we proactively try to develop the critical thinking skills and problem solving skills among our students. So problem solving has been a central instructional strategy in Republic Polytechnic since its founding. And all year one students go through a general module called critical thinking and problem solving. So what do you think we can do more of, and where does RP stand in terms of our efforts to develop critical thinking among our students?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not really informed enough to pass a comment on the specific practices you're using at RP, but what I would suggest is that orientation to critical thinking and problem solving is very important, but it needs to be practiced in all of the courses and content. It also needs to be practiced in all the student associations you have. It needs to be practiced and enacted in the work experiences that students are having. So it's not just, you know, doing a front end thing which can be helpful for making people aware of their responsibilities to be problem solvers and to be critical thinkers, but it needs to be rehearsed and practiced and emphasized in all of them, not only the course content, but other things that students are engaged with. And, you know, one thing I think really interesting I find when I visit, you know, polytechnics such as RP is all of the student associations and the engagements that students have and the activities that they have. And it needs to extend to that so that it becomes, you know, a principle of how people go about, you know, the things that they do. So I think, as I was saying, that these, you know, strategies then need to be embedded in the curriculum, they need to be embedded in the assessment, and they need to be embedded in the instruction. But with all these things, they're all things that are best learnt, so that not taught. So models need to be provided about how to go about things, and then you progress from there. Years ago, I haven't read it recently, but there was an American researcher, Scarmedia, And she came up with the idea of reciprocal teaching and learning. And this was for maths and English literature, language, sorry. And what she would do is she would open a book with her students. She would read a section and then provide an account as an expert of what she was taking from the text. So she would model a process, and then a student would then read the next section and be encouraged to say what they were taking from the text, and so on and so forth around the class. So I think that kind of process where the educator models something, and then as soon as possible, the students engage in that activity themselves. And then, you know, obviously these tasks can be improved, and you can have what's called the spiral curriculum, where you do things in greater detail and depth and focus in drawing out those critical capacities. So it's the action of the teachers, it's the way their experiences are provided, and an openness to failure, an openness to making mistakes, a tolerance to that, and an openness to innovative responses. I'm not really au fait with all of your curriculum and pedagogic practices, so I don't want to say too much more than that. And then I think finally is, wherever possible, to try and provide experiences beyond the academy, beyond the polytechnic. Now, I was a bit surprised years ago when I learnt that students in the polytechnics were not encouraged to take paid part-time work. And what we know is that paid part-time work can often be a very good insight into the world of work and help young people develop basic disciplines such as, you know, turning up to the workplace on time, you know, working with others, taking responsibility for your actions, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think trying to be immersed in the world beyond the polytechnic through paid part-time work, also through work experience and placements or work experience projects, I think that's probably going to be helpful to assist the transition from what is learnt and what is modelled and taught in terms of problem-solving approaches in the polytechnic to circumstances outside of it. I mean, we know this with something like mathematics. We know all too well that the transfer of mathematical skills to application beyond pencil and paper tests in the classroom is very low, because people don't see the things that they do, which are mathematically based in the workplace, as being about maths, because it doesn't seem to be like the maths that you did in classrooms. Yet we all use mathematical computations in our everyday work, yet we don't necessarily link that and draw from what we perhaps learnt in our mathematics class. So I think it's very important to try and, you know, take things outside that shopping list. Look at the items on the shopping list. You know, what's the mean, the mode, and what is the most expensive, and what's the average, and why are things more important than others? You know, practical mathematics, for instance, takes mathematics, for instance, or science from the classroom to other applications. So externalizing what occurs within any education institution seems to be important for its applicability beyond the classroom, so to speak.
Yes, thanks, Stephen. We have come to the end of the interview. Thank you for sharing your thoughts and reflections with us today. I'm sure myself and our readers will benefit from the 1 hour of your sharing. So we do indeed can learn a lot from your 1 hour with Stephen.
Thank you, Anthony, for the interview. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Chuyi, are you there? Can you help us stop the recording? I don't know where she went. So, Stephen, I think you have you had lunch?
About to have it now. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I think I will stay. Then you can leave. So the recording will still go on. I just ask Chewie to stop the recording when she comes back.
Okay. All right.
Okay. Thank you.
And we'll catch up soon. Okay.
Yeah. Sure.
Okay.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye bye. Hello?
Hello?
Can you stop the recording?
Done already. Okay. Okay, I'll stop now. Okay.
Bye.